hope you'll indulge me a brief plug before we start the show today. This is publication week from my new book, Dogland. It's partly the story of the Westminster Dog Show and how a gorgeous white dog named Striker takes aim for the title of Best in Show. But more than that, it's about the bond between dogs and their people, a connection that goes back as far as 30,000 years. Dogland is available now, wherever you buy books. I'd be honored if you gave it a read. Now on to today's episode.
Nothing that I've written about, none of these family secrets are family secrets at all, because they weren't something I uncovered in some trunk under some, you know, some bed somewhere. They were in the newspaper.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. If you've spent much time in Atlanta, you know about the Candler family. The one people probably know most is Asa Griggs Candler, who founded Coca-Cola and brought Emory University to Decatur. Pete Candler, a writer and photographer now living in Asheville, heard those family stories when he was growing up. But there were a lot of other Candler stories that no one in the family dared talk about. Pete Candler discovered those stories and more as part of a series of road trips he took around the South over a span of more than 20 years. He's compiled those journeys into a book called A Deeper South, which comes out in May. It's about the stories the South likes to tell and probably shouldn't, and also about the stories the South doesn't tell and most definitely should. Here's our conversation. Pete Candler, this book is about a lot of things, but the framework for it is a road trip story. Did you have any other sort of road trip stories in your mind as you were starting to write, or maybe out on the road itself?
I'm sure I did. Which ones I was conscious of at the time, I'm not sure. But, you know, as a kid growing up in the 1970s and 80s, it was a great time for car enthusiasts because they were everywhere on TV and movies and everything. Smoking the Bandit was like, I was probably 6 years old when that came out. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen that film, Cannonball Run. I mean, and of course, on TV, we had the Dukes of Hazzard, we had Knight Rider, and all of these movies that are movies and TV shows that were kind of built around cars. And of course, Cannonball Run was a great road trip movie. I'm sure that stuck somewhere deep in my soul early on. I later read some books that were more road narratives, William Least, Heat Moons, Blue Highways, which I think anybody who's ever done a road trip across the U.S. has to have read portions of at least. Travels with Charlie, John Steinbeck's account of going cross country in his truck with his dog. And I'm sure there were others. Those were actually came along after John and I started these trips in 1997. They really originated out of a desire just to see this region that we both had grown up in. But I mean, you know Atlanta well. You know that it is a bit of an oasis in the South, for better or worse, kind of removed from the rest of the region in some ways, or at least particularly the, you know, white Protestant private school bubble that I grew up in. When John and I, we both went to the same college. We both went to Wake Forest together, and we read Flannery O'Connor together there. And that was really the thing that triggered this whole thing for us. So in a way, I guess the road trip really goes back to Flannery O'Connor, because in her great story, A Good Man Is Hard to Find, it is all about an ill-fated road trip to Florida. So I guess in a way, yeah, to answer, circle back to your original question, maybe we were hoping for a better ending than A Good Man Is Hard to Find, but that one really stuck in our craw, I think.
You'll appreciate this, I think. When I was a student at UGA in the 80s, we used to go to Milledgeville on Sundays, Milledgeville being known at the time for well, several things that you mentioned in the book. Two things in particular drew it to us. One is you could go see the Peacocks at Flannery O'Connor's place. And two, Milledgeville at the time, I think, was the only place in Georgia where you could buy beer on Sunday.
Yeah.
And so we would occasionally take a road trip to experience both of those things. So this book is layered with two trips at least that you and your friend John took, and maybe there were others in between. What made you want to come back after you had kind of done this once or more already?
Yeah, I think we did five trips between 1997 and 2004, and then took a long break, not really on purpose, but I had moved out to Texas to take a job out there, and John was working, I think at the time he was still working at a high school up in Western North Carolina, eventually ended up, doing a PhD at UGA and then ending up in Augusta with a professorship there. You know, life and kids and marriages and all that stuff kind of intervened. We did do one trip from Texas when John came out, and he stayed with us for a while. We left from Central Texas and kind of made it back to Louisiana and Mississippi as quickly as we could. But that was the last one we did for about 14 years. And what happened to reignite the tours really was a dinner I had with a friend in Pasadena called Tom Zellner, who's a great writer and a great road writer and has written a lot about, he's from Arizona. He's written about I-10. He's written a great book about trains and traveling around the world on trains. We had met in Suwannee in 2016. And so I happened to be in Pasadena a couple of years later. And we started talking about road trips. And he said, well, had you ever done any road trips? And I said, well, you know, funny you should ask, because I have this sort of ongoing road trip, sort of like Bob Dylan's tour, you know, the never-ending road trip kind of thing that is sort of on and off for a number of years. And we've been thinking about doing it again, but have just never really found the time. Tom really encouraged, almost demanded that I go back on the road that summer because, you know, what was really compelling for him as an editor and as a writer was the perspective of going back from a bit of a distance.
Well, this maybe fits into that. You talked at one point about, you mentioned this in the context of Charleston, but I think probably applies to the rest of the journey as well, that to see the place, first you had to unsee it. From your perspective, what does that mean?
Well, in the case of Charleston, I think I approached Charleston like everyone in the South and maybe around the country approaches Charleston. I know there will be people who will contest this claim, but Charleston's maybe the most mythologized city in the Southeast. I know there New Orleanians will contest that. Charleston has this reputation as this sort of bastion of the old South. It's a beautiful town. It's kind of European in some ways. It feels like if you're a European visitor and you come to Charleston, you might recognize just in the shape of the cityscape and so forth, the connection. And I think that connection between England in particular and Charleston is very strong, and it's very much a part of the messaging. For example, you still see churches in Charleston that identify, and this is before the more recent split between Episcopal Church and these offshoots, Anglican churches. But there are churches that will still identify with as Anglican, i.e. belonging to the Church of England. That sense of Englishness or the direct lineage, it's part of the charm. I think it's part of the advertising copy in Charleston. Charleston, I mean, is irresistible. I love Charleston. It's a fantastic place. It's also one of the, how to put this, it's got a rich trove of really dark history. Let's put it that way. You won't encounter necessarily on the surface, even if you're wandering around for a little bit. In 97, when we first went there, the the John C. Calhoun monument still towered over Marion Square. Now it's no longer there. Charleston is very good at keeping secrets. I think if it excels at anything, it's keeping secrets. And one of the books that really opened that up for me was Pat Conroy's Lords of Discipline. And, you know, Conroy's one of these people I had perhaps unfairly associated Conroy with beach literature. You know, it's the kind of book you read sitting on a lounge chair in August, which was unfair because the beginning of Lords of Discipline for me evoked this passage at the beginning of, this will sound really nerdy for a minute, but at the beginning of Balzac's Père Goriot, which is this 18th century novel about Paris. He uses the catacombs and the sort of underground of Paris as a metaphor for what Paris doesn't tell you on the surface. And I think Charleston was very similar. I don't know if Conroy was thinking of this. I think he really powerfully evoked for me the kind of underground of Charleston that is somehow essential to that surface level presentation, the charm, and so forth. And there is a connection. There has to be some connection between the defiance that Charleston represents. I mean, wonderfully in many ways. I mean, the Charleston skyline is preserved as it is, you know, no skyscrapers and so forth, because of this sort of defiant resistance against modern architecture. On the other hand, that is connected to a defiant sort of resistance to the truth of what made Charleston, Charleston, which is, of course, slavery. I mean, the slave trade made Charleston what it is.
You mentioned early on in that answer about keeping secrets. I feel like this is where we kind of need to bring up your family. So I'm not going to get any of this close to correct, but I knew, you know, before I picked up this book, that the Candler family was well known and prominent, especially in Atlanta. I guess my knowledge of it was that one of your ancestors, Asa Griggs Candler, sort of founded Coca-Cola. I did not know about all the other Candlers and their offshoots that play roles in this book as you try to sort this out. Do you want to try to untangle that a little bit, or how do you want to talk about that?
I was in the same position you were. I mean, for most of my life, I knew about Asa. You know, Asa started the Coca-Cola company. My connection to him was he was my great-great-grandfather's brother. For most of my life, I knew very little about that family history, even the Coca-Cola part of it. So I kind of knew that that was sort of out there. I knew that other people knew about it. His name was on buildings and streets in Atlanta and stuff. And I knew that he had brothers and sisters, and I knew that one of them was, you know, I was directly descended from. And in fact, I knew really, I think, three of those siblings. It was Asa, there was the bishop, and there was the judge. There's three brothers, and they were the youngest three of 11 children. I've already talked about Asa, and then Warren was the bishop, a Methodist bishop of Georgia, who became the first, he was the president of Emory College and then became chancellor of Emory University when Asa gave the land to move the campus from Oxford to Decatur. And then John Slaughter Candler, who was my great-great-grandfather, and he was the judge. This is how we knew them, just by these sort of monikers. And he was a Supreme Court justice for the state of Georgia and chief legal counsel for the Coca-Cola company. And they were very close with each other. For example, when John had his first child, his first boy, at least, was named Asa Warren Candler for his two older brothers. So John was the youngest of 11. I should definitely credit their mother, who was a very small woman in height. She was like 4'10", but was apparently a force of nature. I mean, she gave birth to 11 children, that alone. But her nickname was Old Hard Shell, which should give you some idea of how relatable a person she was. But anyhow, yeah, so growing up, it was like the judge, Asa, and the bishop. And that was basically all I knew about these people.
Yeah, I was going to say, Pete, and what, like your immediate family, like your parents and that sort of thing. I mean, I don't know how to ask this except just to ask it. Did you grow up in like a wealthy family because of all the other Candlers before you?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I definitely grew up in what by any metrics would count as a wealthy family. I mean, I think there is within the particular kind of weirdness that my family has sort of cultivated over the years. There is this strange sort of internal distinction between like the Asa's descendants and the rest of us. For example, there was even a book written back in the 90s, I think it was, by a descendant of Asa's called The Real Ones, which was like about the descendants of King Asa, you know. And so it's all totally ridiculous. But yeah, I definitely grew up actually lived over off of near Chastain Park as a kid. And then later we moved to West Wesley, went to private school. I mean, I had all the benefits and privileges of, you know, a generational wealth.
But that family history sounds like was not something that got discussed around the dinner table.
Never, never. We actually just did a first in my dad's family. He had three brothers. He has three brothers and sisters. And we have never, ever done reunions. We just don't do reunions. I don't know. I mean, it's just, so it's too bad. But anyway, we did our first one this last year. It had been like 20 years since a plurality of that group had gotten together. One member of the group got up during a dinner and extolled the Irishness of our family. We talked about, you know, how we had brought this Irish identity, how it animated our family, and so we embodied these characteristics that we identify with being Irish and stuff. And it turns out, you know, it was very moving, but it turns out to be total BS because we weren't Irish at all. In fact, you know, I have some friends who are really Irish, and if they ever heard me tell this story, they would probably never talk to me again because the legend is, okay, you may know Callenwald. You probably know Callenwald in Atlanta. It's in Decatur. I'm sure many of your listeners do. It's a fine arts center. Now it's a beautiful Tudor home that belonged to Charles Howard Candler, who was one of Asa's. He was one of the real ones. He was one of Asa's sons. The house is named Callenwald for Callan, the town. It's a little town in Southeast Ireland. That is supposedly the ancestral home. And then Wald is supposed to mean woods in Irish or something. Candler Woods was how this word was translated. That was the mythology that Callan was this town in Ireland that our people came from. Which is not untrue. They did spend time in Callan, but they only spent time there, and the only reason it became a home of any kind is because one of the ancestors, called William Candler, was an officer in Oliver Cromwell's army, who invaded Ireland in 1650, and as a reward for his service to Cromwell, was given. Or your listeners can't see me making the quotes with my fingers, but. Given this manor house in Callan and presumably a lot of land, which of course it belonged to someone else and essentially stole it and gave it to William Candler. That, you know, that part of the story is conveniently left out because it doesn't make for a very good self-aggrandizing mythology.
Do you feel like this lack of discussion of the family history was in any way like shame or embarrassment or anything, because there's a lot of other family history we haven't gotten to yet that's much worse? Or was it just sort of, I don't know, ignorance is not the right word, but just sort of acceptance of what it was? Was it not worth talking about?
That is a great question. There are probably multiple answers to that. The first one is my family isn't especially forthcoming about anything. So it's not like we don't share stories, particularly ones that aren't flattering necessarily. I think just what I know from my family history, my experience, is that there probably is some shame involved, but my ignorance of this history was a function of what I can only conclude to be generations worth of active suppression of memory or active silence about this history. And the reason I say that is because, I mean, I think it took years and years of emotional, psychological effort not to talk about this stuff because it was public knowledge. And so when I was writing this book, nothing that I've written about, none of these family secrets are family secrets at all, because they weren't something I uncovered in some trunk under some, you know, some bed somewhere. They were in the newspaper or they were in public library materials. So nothing was under the table. This was all common knowledge, at least to readers of the newspapers in Atlanta and around the country in the late 19th century. I think that was the real shocking thing for me was, you know, when I'm telling some of these stories to my father, he had never heard any of this. So even by his generation, the sort of regime of silence had been very effective. I think that has bequeathed to me and my generation, maybe I'll just speak for myself, a certain kind of hesitancy to talk about certain things that this book was an attempt to overcome in some ways.
You talk in detail about several family members. Is there one that you felt like, as you discovered their history, that kind of made you recoil the most, I guess?
Well, I wish there was only one. There were several. The one figure that this whole story really revolves around, or became the kind of pivot point, I guess, for me, was Allen Candler, who was governor of Georgia from 1898 to 1902. And he's actually not in that generation of 11 kids. He was first cousin to them. So the only thing I knew growing up about Allen Candler was that he had written this little biography of William Candler, the Irish progenitor of the Georgia branch of the family, that both contributed to this mythology and actually kind of undermined it slightly if you read closely. And the reason why he's so central to this story is because it goes back to a lunch I had with a friend of mine here in Asheville called David Moltke Hansen, who was a director of the Center for the Study of the American South in Chapel Hill. He said, I'd love to have lunch with you, which I was like, yeah, great. He said, oh, by the way, there's this book I wanted to tell you about. Okay. And any book recommendation I get from David, I'm going to take seriously, because this is a historian who knows everything, you know, and he's seen it all. He said, yeah, it's about the lynching of Sam Hose. And I'd never heard the name Sam Hose, but I was intrigued. And he said, yeah, your family comes up quite a bit in the book. And I thought, well, I'm not sure I really want to read this book just yet. But when I went to go read the Sam Hose story, that's by Donald Matthews was the author of that book, and it was a really thorough account. And indeed, my family did come up quite a bit, including the judge, and including Allen, who was governor during the lynching of Sam Hose in 1899 in Noonan, Georgia, about 38, 40 miles south of Atlanta. Never heard any of this stuff, never heard this story. And it was one of the most notorious lynchings in American history among, and there are a lot of contenders for that. I mean, they're all notorious, but some are at a level of deliberateness that others may not be. So, for example, the Sam Hose story was that he had allegedly, he was working on a guy called Alfred Cranford, I think was his name, in Noonan, working on his property. At some point, there was a dispute, and Sam Hose murdered him with an axe and then fled. So he's on the lam for like 2 weeks. This is manhunt all over the South. In the meantime, of course, the newspapers are just ginning the story up. They're adding details, you know, that are more salacious and completely unsubstantiated. Governor Candler is asked to give a statement. And his statement basically goes, you know, the black people of Noonan had every opportunity to present themselves as good, upstanding citizens, and they blew it. So he penned the whole thing not on the, you know, not on the mob of lynchers, which included so-called respectable citizens, as well as, you know, riffraff. He basically blamed it on the black community, which of course is a longstanding trope and something that we haven't really outgrown entirely.
And this is where, to me, the whole everything sort of comes together in what you're talking about, because it's about your family, it's about this Southern history, and it's about what you know, kind of mention in the book is this like collective amnesia that not everybody, I'm sure a lot of black people in the South haven't forgotten any of those stories if they've heard them, but certainly in the official sort of narrative of the South and among the white South, those things just tend to get forgotten. And it sounds like that not just the things that are related to your family, but on this trip, you heard a lot of things that you had never heard before, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Some of them, of course, were related to my family, especially around Atlanta, but there were so many others that were just, I mean, I could probably run off just in one region a handful of events and people that I was shocked I had never heard about. I think the one that really sticks out for me and the one that is maybe the easiest one to kind of take home for people was the story of Robert Smalls. I know there are a couple of books that came out about this story. There should be. There absolutely should be, because this story is like, it's one of those, you just cannot believe you've never heard this story. You cannot believe. So traveling around the South, you know, you see, I don't know how many monuments to Nathan Bedford Forrest. And we can talk about the one in Selma if we have time. He's everywhere. There's not a single monument to Robert Smalls except in Beaufort, South Carolina, which is where Smalls is from, and where he's buried, there's a bust of him on the sidewalk next to the church where he's buried. He was enslaved in Charleston at the beginning of the Civil War, and of course, before that as well. In 1862, he commandeers a Confederate steamboat with his family aboard, steams past Confederate and then Union naval lines in Charleston Harbor, and lands the boat on a little plot of shore just north of the Battery. Basically steams to freedom. For that alone, Robert Smalls is a legend. But then he becomes a state legislator. He becomes a United States representative. Just he is a model of Reconstruction, of the experiment in Reconstruction. Robert Smalls is like the representative of what that's supposed to look like. He's also representative of the failure of Reconstruction, because by the end of his life, Smalls is reduced. I mean, he's not the hero that he once was. He's now basically fighting the same battles that he began his political career fighting. The sort of overturning of Reconstruction in the late 1860s, and well, depending on where you are, in the 1870s, Smalls is, his fortunes have basically reversed. But, I mean, this is where the story is so fascinating. He managed to purchase the house in which he was born into slavery, which is just this incredible overturning, you know, this sort of upside down story. Again, this is like, this is made for, I mean, it's like, you can't believe you've never heard this. It's such, even, it's just an amazing story on its own, regardless of what it says about American history, which is a lot. Now that site is preserved. You know, this is one of those instances where Beaufort's almost religious devotion to historical preservation is a godsend, because Smalls' house is now, I mean, it's still, as far as I know, basically identical to how it was in his time. It's a beautiful home. And it's this story that encapsulates one aspect of the Black experience during Reconstruction. And also just a character, a single figure who had unbelievable courage. There should be 1,000 Robert Smalls monuments for every, well, that's not even true. There really shouldn't be any Nathan Bedford Forrest monuments, but you should see Smalls all over the country.
When we come back, Pete Gantler talks about how the language regarding the South's history has begun to change.
Plantation sounds lovely. In reality, these were forced labor camps.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to our conversation with Pete Gantler. What you've done basically in this book is write kind of an alternative history of the South. I'm wondering, for all those people who may be having, by listening to all this, the same experience that you originally had of not knowing all this stuff, wanting to find out more, how do we flip the switch where this becomes the mainstream history, where this is what people just naturally learn?
I think institutionally, there's a lot going on in terms of the way these narratives are getting flipped. I mean, one of them is at the Whitney Plantation in Louisiana. You know, traditionally, plantations were oriented around the lives of the plantation owners. And Whitney Plantation reversed that and has oriented the entire experience of visiting there around what it was like for enslaved people on a labor camp, not a plantation. Even the language around these sites is changed. You know, not plantation sounds lovely. In reality, these were forced labor camps. And as a level of kind of public history, a lot is changing. I was back in August, I was in the Mississippi Delta for the dedication of a couple of sites related to the Emmett Till lynching. And one of those is now the site where his body was recovered is now a National Park Service site. And so the first time John and I stumbled on this, we weren't really even looking for it necessarily. We happened upon this site because there were some historical markers that were really prominent. You know, they're purple historical markers that indicated what the river site, and it points you on the main road and then down the gravel road. There was another one there, and you probably read about it in the news. It had been shot up multiple times. It had been shot up right before we got there, and then after they replaced it, was shot up again a few weeks after we left. Some students from Ole Miss were caught on video camera, I think it was, like, vandalizing the sign, and then some white supremacist group was videotaped, they were recorded demonstrating in front of the sign. The fact that, you know, this attempt to restore the memory of Emmett Till and what happened to him in that part of Mississippi has met with a lot of resistance from some white people. Now, you know, it is a federal felony to vandalize the sign that is there now. It is a National Park Service site, and that is a significant move. And a lot of people work really hard to make this happen.
How do you feel like this experience, these road trips, and then writing about them, how's it changed you?
Really, this story was about, like, what all this stuff has to do with me. This is not a how-to book on, you know, how to confront the legacy of white supremacy or how to be anti-racist or anything like that. But it was, for me, a very personal story. And if there's anything I hope readers will take away from it, is how to direct that same question to themselves. You know, what does all of this stuff have to do with me? The answer in every single case is not nothing. And there is something that every single one of us has to learn. And I say especially, but not only white people, have to learn about a kind of vulnerability to the truth of our history. I think there was a certain reticence. Let me not put that in the passive voice. I had a certain reticence towards my own family history of talking about it growing up, because, you know, I think if you come from, you know, a prominent family like I do, there's always a suspicion that you'll be judged not on your own merits, but because, you know, oh, you're just a member of the Candler family. Like, you got all of this, you know, you inherited a certain kind of comfort in the world. I do feel like it has made me less defensive about all of that and about my own family history, and I hopefully more attentive to the stories that don't get told. As far as my family history goes, I think when I was doing this stuff the second time around, you know, from 2018 on, when my youngest was 4, but my older kids who were learning some of this history too, they didn't have this sort of baggage that I did towards my ancestors. They just felt like these were interesting people who did some interesting, sometimes really disturbing stuff. But, like, as far as the characters themselves, yes, they were complicated, you know, conflicted, but they were worth learning about. And so that kind of allowed me to just let go of some of this. Even the process of this book and getting it out there, you know, my family, just sort of the recognizability of my family name, it's different for other people than it is for me. And so, you know, for some people, that's really interesting. And I think for me, it was just kind of like, I guess, you know, whatever. But I think it allowed me to let go of some of those hangups about my family history. And hopefully, at a personal level, it's made me aware of kind of how deep the defensive Gene goes. I mean, it's not just about family or Southern history, but that sort of defensive posture. It's really deep, and kind of unlearning that, it's a challenge, and it's a lifelong exercise. But for me, it's always the organic relationship between my personal life and my, you know, the well-being of my soul is connected to this project and this book and everything around it, because at the heart of it is the conviction that essential to the well-being of any human person, and by extension any collective or city or nation, is a restored memory.
I've never been a big fan of putting up statues to human beings, dead or alive. Our perspectives change, and yesterday's hero can become today's monster. But I might make an exception for what you might call the reverse Confederate maneuver. Just go to every town where there's a Confederate monument, take it down, and replace it with a black hero or martyr from that time, or maybe a little after. People like the ones Pete Candler mentioned, Robert Smalls, for example, or maybe Sam Hose. As Candler said in our interview, the South, or at least a large segment of the white South, suffers from collective amnesia about what our ancestors did. Candler learned about his ancestors the hard way. The rest of us should remember the lives that were stolen, scarred, and sometimes ended by those who fought for a lost cause. When we start talking about that honestly, not just in the public square, but as part of a basic Southern education, then maybe we can finally turn the corner. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.